Welcome to the Spotting Session. I'm your host, Dana Solomon, a film composer and keyboardist. This is episode number 2. The topic that I'll be discussing with you today is your first independent film project and what can you expect as a film composer scoring it. So I just want to personally say thank you again for sharing some of your free time to listen to what it is that I can say to hopefully help you and or your colleagues or whomever it might be that's interested in composing music for film or just composing in general, music in general, technology and so forth. I have a genuine interest and passion in just sharing with everyone the knowledge that I've picked up and accrued over the years doing this professionally. And I want to be enlightening to whoever is willing to listen and hopefully learn from my experience of what I've done for some time in this subject matter. So I'm going to enjoy sharing a couple of different points of topics that I can share with you. And this will probably go into more than one part. I'm probably going to split this episode up into more than one part. I don't want to basically have it going on and on for a whole hour nonstop or more. Unless, you know, I get feedback from some people saying that they don't mind listening to a whole podcast that's a whole hour straight. And I know some people, they don't mind. I know myself, I don't really care. But for right now, being that this is my second episode of me launching the new podcast, the Spotting Session of my own, you know, I just kind of wanted to break it up into maybe 30-minute segments, something like that, so that people can kind of digest what I'm saying and split it up and you know, just be able to access it whenever they need to. But either way, I just want to be of help, and I'm going to start with the first point that I want to make concerning this topic. So the first point that I want to make in regards to this episode and this title of the things that you can expect as a film composer scoring your first independent film project is, as a composer, you need to use a template. A template is very important. You absolutely should use a template. You don't have to if it's something small and minor, but you know, if you're going to be working on some type of project where the soundtrack is going to be, you know, it's looking for a full arrangement, like a bigger arrangement, especially if you're doing something orchestral, or it could just be something, it could be something ambient or electronic, but it's, you know, it's asking for, you know, a full sound. And when I say full sound, I mean, you know, covering the full audio spectrum or frequencies of audio spectrums. So the human ear basically can only hear within the audible range of 20 hertz at the bottom, the lowest, you know, we could basically hear all the way up to 20,000 hertz, which would also be 20 kilohertz. So from 20 hertz all the way to 20 kilohertz is the audible range of the human ear. And to be honest with you, as we get older, you know, we start to slightly lose our hearing. So, you know, 20 kilohertz is really kind of a stretch. You're not going to really hear anything quite up to that range anyway. I think the only humans that can probably hear anything that high would probably be babies, because their hearing hasn't been damaged and their ears are pretty much fresh, you know, after birth. So they hear a lot of different things. And I mean, only other mammals that can probably hear something that high would probably be bats or something like that, you know, with something that high. But either way, when I say a full arrangement, I'm saying hearing the melody and music and sounds and tones from the lows all the way to the mid lows, to the mid frequencies, to the upper mid frequencies, to the high frequencies, all in between, from 20 hertz all the way up to 20 kilohertz. So that means if you were listening to high strings, to maybe the highest woodwinds like a piccolo or something, or to frequency instruments like violas or the upper range of cellos, from high to low, like trumpets to horns to trombones to tubas to snare drums to toms, tom drums, or to surdo drums, Brazilian surdo drums, or conga percussions, or taiko drums, to bass grincasa drums, to it could be synth bass, like a Moog synth bass, or it could be Juno pads, or Roland JX8P pads, which I actually had the pleasure of owning once, a JX8P, real analog Roland synth. Yeah, I mean, the full range of instrumentation that you can use when you're doing that many tracks in your arrangement, and you're making such a full sound, then it's going to require a lot of different tracks. So the reason for a template, the reason why a lot of composers and music producers use templates, is because when you want to start putting sounds together for an arrangement, and when you want to start the composition, and your inspiration kicks in, and you start with the flow of creativity of what you want to create thematically as a composer, as a musician, you're going to start adding sounds and adding sounds and adding sounds. And, you're going to start going through the different sample libraries that you've acquired, and you're going to start, instantiating those instruments and those plugins into your DAW of choice that you use. If you are doing a full arrangement, it's going to be very tiring after a while for you to have to go in and instantiate or start and create, like, it could be 15, 20 different tracks or more. Now, I know with my orchestral templates that I have, that I use, which my sample library of choice that I use for orchestration are VSL sample libraries for my orchestration. They're not the only ones that I've used before, but I'm still kind of partial to Vienna Symphonic Library orchestral libraries. And that's not to say that they're the best. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying they're my personal preference, because there's some phenomenal ones out there. And I don't use exclusively just VSL. I also use Spitfire, and I use, some other stuff from East West, and, other libraries as well, from Heaviosity and Output and several others you can name from Native Instruments, of course, as well. But the majority of what I would say the crux of my template I use is from that particular sample library or company, VSL. And I have everything laid out from the high strings to the mid to the low strings and the brass and percussion. And I probably have, I don't really know without me looking offhand, I might have something like, I don't know, my template might have something like 50, 60 something MIDI tracks, maybe slightly more. I have about maybe 50, 60 tracks in my template. And basically the way that works when you're setting up a template, the reason for it is that you don't have to create 50, 60 new tracks every time you start a new project for a film that you're going to work on. By the time you finish creating 20, 30 new tracks or 40 new tracks, you're just going to be too mentally fatigued to even think about having any inspiration for looking for a thinking of a new melody, a new theme, a new motif that you can compose to. You know, the last thing you're going to start thinking about are keys and rhythm and, you know, timbre and all that stuff after you've done all this, you know, administrative stuff, this mundane thing of, you know, finding this VST and then, you know, instantiating that and then setting this MIDI channel and then setting this instrument and then setting up this MIDI control option with your controller and, you know, testing it out and, you know, setting the output correctly and, you know, all these different things that you do behind the scenes. And, you know, with a template, it loads up everything as soon as you select that in your DAW, and all you have to do is start composing. So if you have not created a template yet in your DAW of choice, whatever DAW you use, and again, you know, as I said before, I use my DAW of preference of choice that I'm using now is Studio One, Presonus Studio One Pro, the latest version as of this particular podcast, version 5. And I'm really loving it. Now, it's not the only one that I've used for the longest because I've used others for many years, but that's what I'm using now. But a template can be created in any DAW. It doesn't matter whether you're using Pro Tools, whether you're using Digital Performer, Cubase, Studio One, Logic from Apple. You could be using FL Studio. You could be using Reason. You know, you could be using, what's the other one that so many people like to use? Well, there's a couple of other ones out there. And I, you know, forgive me if I can't name them off the top of my head right now. But it doesn't really matter because all you're doing with a template is you're just taking the time aside one day when you have like a couple of hours free of your time and you're just setting up each track that you think would help you out with composing before you have to start a particular project. So whenever you need it, you can just start it at any given time and just start composing instead of worrying about starting all that stuff. So in another way to explain it is, let's say if you were doing music production, let's say you were going to do a song for an artist. Let's say you're going to do, you know, a ballad, an adult contemporary ballad or a pop song or R&B song or whatever. Then you would, you know, with your template, you would just go ahead and set up, you know, one track for your, maybe your piano, another track for maybe your electric piano, like Rhodes, another track for maybe like one type of synth, another track for like maybe another type of synth that'll do just maybe strings or pads, then another track that'll do just maybe synth arpeggios or something like that, then another track for just like the bass, maybe a bass guitar, electric bass, like a precision bass, or Fender bass or fretless or whatever it might be, another track just for your drums, another track just for your percussion, maybe some other tracks that you would set aside just for vocals, for recording vocals, another track maybe set aside for rhythm guitar and so forth. You get the point of what I'm saying. And then once you set up all these tracks, your template now already has like about 12 or 14 tracks already set up beforehand and ready to go. So in every DAW, you have an option where you can just save that project that you just created. You can save it as a template. Usually in every DAW, it's that way. I couldn't imagine any modern DAW at this time that wouldn't allow you that functionality. And if it doesn't have it, then all you have to do is just save that particular project that you created with all of those tracks and just put it somewhere on your hard drive. And then every time you start, you can just open that up and then you save it as a different name. But as far as I know, every DAW in modern times allows you to save that as your own customized template. I've listened to some people that say they don't use templates. They just kind of go with the flow and they just start instantiating tracks as they go along for the first time. I've done that before too, but I've normally done that when I know that it's going to be a very minimalist type score where it's only going to be like maybe three or four tracks. So, you know, if I know it's going to be very minor and it's just going to be maybe myself playing piano and just having like some string minor, like black string chords that I'm playing with my, like I'm playing like a pad or just have pads there. in the background, synth pads, then nah, it's not really necessary to, you know, have a template going. I could basically just do that on the fly. It's not going to really make a difference. So that's one of the things I would say. Do yourself a favor. If you haven't done it, create a template. That's what I would say, especially if you're going to get into orchestration. If you want to do full arrangements, yeah, create a template, because it's going to be a major drag on your inspiration sitting there going MIDI track after MIDI channel after MIDI track and instrument, virtual instrument track, setting that up for the first time and doing that over and over 10, 20, 30, 40 different times before you even start to score the first note of a melody for your project. So keep that in mind. The second point, second topic for this episode that I want to talk about of what you can do, or the same things that you're going to basically, you know, keep in mind over and over with each coming and new film project as a composer. The second topic I want to discuss has to do with your sample library. Your sample library is something that you're going to develop over time. And, you know, as a composer, as a musician, as an artist, you're going to gravitate to certain sample libraries that you feel are going to work best for you. And as a composer, you definitely have to have top-notch sample libraries. You have to have libraries that sound as real as possible. And as of this year of this podcast, which is 2021, the level of quality of sample libraries that you can acquire nowadays is just through the roof. I mean, it's just phenomenal compared to what it was years ago. You can, I mean, with really good MIDI programming, good, you know, advanced MIDI programming on your own part, and great arrangements and understanding your sample library, I mean, you can make some very convincing compositions and arrangements, you know, especially a score for a film. So I would certainly say, if you really want to get serious and if you really want to indulge in composing soundtracks for films, or whatever it might be, it could be trailers, it could be video games, you know, it could be for commercials, you know, you might want to do ad marketing, type, projects, you know, you might want to just get into working with libraries, you know, music libraries that do placements for stuff like, ads or whatever it might be. You know, the sample libraries nowadays are just, I think they're affordable, and I think you get a very good amount of quality, exceptional quality for what you're paying for. I certainly don't have the means to go out and sample a grand piano. I don't have the means of going out and sampling a Steinway or a grand piano or a Bösendorfer grand piano or a Kawai grand piano or a Fender Rhodes suitcase electric piano. Or the means to go out and sample Yamaha Maple drum kit or DW drum kit or Remo or Tama, a Fender Strat guitar. I don't have the means of going out and sampling all those things the way I would want to. And even if I did, you still have to program all of those samples so that, you know, they're playable as an actual instrument on your computer. So I think too many times people minimize what types of dedication and expertise and technique and technical know-how goes into the creation of sample libraries. And, you know, it's definitely a finesse to it. It's an art to it. And I mean, the people that create sample libraries, for the most part, I would have to assume the majority of them are musicians themselves, you know, in order for them to like doing something like that. I mean, who do you know would love to be able to sit there, who loves, you know, sitting in front of timpanis with a microphone and just tapping them, you know, in like 5, 6, 7, 8 different dynamic levels from pianissimo all the way up to fortissimo over and over and over, so that they can create multi-samples and round robin attacks. I mean, who does that unless that's really your passion and you really appreciate the art and the realism that you're providing for other musicians? So, you know, sample libraries are very key. They're worth their weight in gold. I certainly appreciate all of the sample library manufacturers and companies out there that provide samples for myself to be able to use as a composer, as a musician, as an artist. I appreciate what you do. I appreciate those that do it very well and do it at a high level of excellency and keep a certain standard with it. So you as a composer, you need to start thinking about creating a core of different sample libraries that are going to be your go-to sounds that you'll be using over and over and over consistently from project to project. Now, that might change over the years, because I do know that I started out with different sample libraries to some degree to what I'm using right now. And that's not to say that they were bad. I don't think any of them were bad. And to some degree, you know, I have to kind of, you know, point the fingers at myself and say that, you know, I wasn't maybe as advanced of a MIDI programmer and composer back then when I was using some of those sample libraries as I am right now. I've progressed, you know? I mean, just like any other musician, you know, even though you may have been playing guitar many years, I can certainly guarantee you that, you know, even after maybe 7, 6, or 10 years of playing guitar, there's still certain things that you've matured and have acquired a certain finesse to once you've been playing it for 20 years. Even though you probably knew the same things, you know, 10 years prior, but, you know, you just kind of start finding your own after a certain while. So I think it's the same way as a composer and as a musician, as a music producer, and you're using certain sample libraries, you know, after a while, you start just getting more comfortable with using certain things like automation and MIDI control with your sample libraries, and knowing how to manipulate it so that it feels and sounds like a performance that a human made as close as possible. So a lot of the sample libraries that I'm using right now are libraries that are my go-to libraries for any project that I start. And you're going to have to decide for yourself what libraries is it that you want to use and invest in for yourself, no matter who it is, you know, no matter who it might be from so many different sample companies. There are so many excellent ones. Read some of the reviews. Check to see what some of them are. But, you know, I'll do another episode to go more in depth about how you can kind of decide and look to see what type of sample libraries are out there for you, for what you want to use, and how to decide how to purchase one for how you compose. But, you know, if that's a topic anyone would like me to talk about, you know, certainly email me at the podcast email address, which is podcast@dosprd.com. And I'll certainly consider doing that and put together an episode for you. But just look into that, you know, a sample library. Make sure you have the necessary sounds, the necessary plugins, the necessary synths that you need to consistently be able to compose and put together arrangements and compositions at a consistent professionalism every time. So take that as something very important that's essential for you. A sample library, as important as certain paints and colors and oils are to an artist that paints, your sample library is the equivalent for you as a music composer. The next topic that we'll be discussing for this episode will be about syncing the video. So that's the next thing that I want to talk about. that you'll need to expect as a film composer scoring your first independent film project. Syncing the video. Now, this isn't going to really take too long to explain because, I mean, pretty much at this day and time, with modern technology and modern digital audio workstations that you use, your DAW of choice, your digital audio workstation of choice, will pretty much take care of this for you. So, you know, this isn't something that you have to really worry about too much technically, but you just need to make certain. It's very important that you just remember this. When you start to compose for a video, right? The person providing you the video, which more than likely is going to be the director, directress, whomever it may be that you're scoring a soundtrack for, they're going to provide the video for you in a format that you can download or somehow, you know, be able to get it to your computer. So whether that's, some type of file sharing service like Google Drive or something, or WeTransfer of the actual QuickTime movie or MP4, they're going to give that to you. You're going to download it to your computer that you use for composing. And then you're going to be importing it into, your digital audio workstation software that's running on your computer. So let's just say you're using Logic, Apple Logic, or if you're using PreSonus Studio One Pro, which I do, you'll take that file. Well, you'll open up a new session for a new project for the first time. And you could open up a new project that is basically, you know, your template you created, like I was just discussing in the previous chapter of this episode, setting up a template or using a template. And then there should be an option in your DAW where you can import a video. You can import a file that's a video. When you import that file, basically, when you go to that command, it's going to ask you to find the video, select the video that you want to import. You find it on your hard drive, wherever you saved it. You import it. And normally what your DAW is going to do is it's going to detect what the frame rate is for that video that they've sent you that you're scoring to. So normally that isn't something you have to worry about. Trying to sync up correctly. Normally your DAW is going to tell you what it is, and it's going to try to adjust accordingly. If you start up a new project in your DAW, there may be some settings that are like default settings that are already there in your project. And, you know, your DAW may be set at 30 frames per second. You know, a new project, it may be set up for 30 frames per second, but the film that you're being emailed is at, you know, 24 frames per second or 23.98 frames per second. When the DAW sees that file and it tries to import it, it's going to let you know. Usually, I haven't really seen a DAW that doesn't indicate this, but it's going to notice that your current project, new project, your fresh project that you started is at a different frame rate than the video that you're about to import and use. So it's going to ask you, do you want to change your project's frame rate to coincide with the film's frame rate that you're about to import? You always want to say yes. If you know that what you're importing is at the correct frame rate, and the director said, yeah, this is locked, this is the frame rate I'm using, this is what everything's recording in, and you know that's correct, then you absolutely want to be certain that your project is at the exact same frame rate. If that video that you're importing is at 23.98 frames per second, then you absolutely want to be certain that your new project that you just started up in your digital audio workstation is at 23.98 frames per second. If the frame rate is at 60 frames per second, then you want to make sure that your DAW is at 60 frames per second because the video you're importing is at 60 frames per second. The reason I say this is because if your frame rate is out of sync and it's not the same as what the film is, your DAW will import the video anyway. The problem, however, with that is that once you start creating music and you start working on cues and you start working on music to send back to the director, you're going to be sending them back music that's at a different frame rate than what they sent to you. So you may be looking at the video at, say, 5 minutes, 32 seconds, frame 10, and you're composing music at 5 minutes, 32 seconds, frame 10, but your DAW is at a different frame rate than what the video is. So when you give it back to the director, you're going to tell them, that this is for this scene at 5 minutes, 32 seconds, frame 10. And they're going to say, man, this doesn't even line up with that. I mean, I can hear what you did, but that's not where that scene even starts that you gave me. So that's the reason for that is because the frame rate or the frames are off. The scenes are off because you're not synchronized to the exact same frames as the video that you're importing that the director gave you. And of course, whatever the director gave you is what matters. That's what you go on. That's the default. That's the correct default that everything is supposed to be synchronized to. So just be certain of that. I mean, 9 times out of 10, it's not something you have to worry about, but that's why it's there. Just so you need to sync your video. The other important thing too with that is when you're importing the video, make sure, this is very important, it's not 100% necessity, but it's better if you go with this. Usually with film composing, 9.99 out of 10, you compose videos at 48 kilohertz, not 44.1 kilohertz. Normally with music production, the people out there that are just doing songs for artists, they will record them at 44.1 kilohertz. For film soundtracks, it's the opposite. Well, I won't say the opposite, but it's different. You normally want to compose always, just assume, I'll put it that way. That's the best way to word it. Just assume that you're going to be composing with this project at 48 kilohertz. And nowadays, of course, the standard that I use is 24-bit 48 kilohertz projects. That's how I start off all of my new projects for a soundtrack for scoring something. 24-bit 48 kilohertz, but absolutely 48 kilohertz. No question about it. I don't do anything at 44.1 kilohertz unless it's just some song that I know I'm giving someone or some instrumentation that I'm creating to be placed in something. And, they can worry about how they want to do that later. But I compose everything. I set all of my new projects at 48 kilohertz. That syncs up perfect with video. And pretty much universally around the world, all video is going to be used at 48 kilohertz, whether it's, any broadcast, platform, they're going to be using 48 kilohertz. Frame rates are subjective, but the sample rate, that's pretty much universal. That's pretty much standard for all film production and post-production. 48 kilohertz is the standard. The next point or the next topic that I want to touch on for is get used to proper labeling and organization with your project. It's something that's going to follow you all the time with every project you worked on, you will be working on. Now, of course, for your first film project, you certainly want to make certain that you are labeling everything that you need to label or everything that you're working on consistently, and you're being certain that you're organizing everything. So what do I mean by proper labeling and organization? So for the most part, the majority of where you're going to be doing most of your work is going to be inside of your computer with your digital audio workstation and your computer, whether you're using a Mac computer or a Windows computer, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter whether you're using, you know, Cubase from Steinberg or Logic Pro or Pro Tools or Studio One or, you know, Reaper or whatever it is, it doesn't really matter. The concept is the same. You're going to start sequencing music. You're going to start sequencing MIDI tracks for your instrumentation. And you're going to continue to stack more and more tracks for your arrangement. And eventually you're going to bounce those down to WAV files so you can mix, which is something else I'm going to touch on in a little bit. And they all have to be saved. So, you know, what you want to do is consistently get into some type of consistent naming scheme or labeling scheme for your tracks. You know, I know what I do with my template is for, you know, my string section in my template. You know, I'll just maybe, I don't remember offhand how I labeled it, but you know, when I was creating the template, I would do something like, you know, for the violin section, I'll go from the top down, which would be like, you know, violins, violas, and celli, and then contrabass or however I have it set up. So I might just have it like high strings or low strings or mid strings or whatever it might be. But basically you want to have a consistent labeling where it's like, you know, maybe violins, you want to write out or type out the full name, violins, V-I-O-L-I-N-S. And maybe you want it violins one. And then the second track will be violins number two, you know. Then, you know, you maybe you want to start on the violas. Or maybe you want to just have it shorthand like I do sometimes with my templates, what I've done. And I'll just say V-L-N-S, short for violins. But I'll put a one beside it so I'll know it's violins one for that track. And then V-L-N-S, two for the second violins, which will be on that track. And then, you know, the same with like maybe brass, you know, maybe for horns, you know, I'll just say horns one, horns two, or trombone one, second trombones, or trumpets. But normally what I do with my templates is I break them up into articulations, or when it comes to strings, their particular bowings that are used in articulation. So, you know, I'll have one track that'll say, you know, violins one, legato, violins one, staccato, violins one, pizzicato, violins one, tremolo, violins one, marcato, violins one, legato, consortino, you know, muted strings. And then I'll do the same thing for maybe violas. Violas, one, legato. And then another one for the same thing like I did with the violins, with staccato, pizzicato, tremolo, muted strings or marcato, and so forth. And, you know, you just go down the list and do that over and over and over. But the good thing about that is when you do that, which is another reason why it's good to have a template, is because you're going to have consistency. And that's what you're looking for. You need consistency with how you're organizing everything. Because the last thing you want to do is to have like 6, 7, 8 different versions of everything that you're working on. You want to be able to get straight to something that you need to figure out what it is that you need to find, especially when you need to go back and make revisions on whatever you're working on. And the last thing you need to be doing is looking through like a whole folder of files on your computer, hard drive, computer's hard drive, and trying to figure out what you were working on 2, 3 days ago, let alone 2, 3 weeks ago. You're not going to remember that. But if everything is labeled consistently, you'll be able to do that. So the other thing I do is just keep this in mind, proper labeling. You know, have a consistent naming convention that you're going to use, a naming scheme as to how you're going to label your tracks. I also, you know, when I'm working on a film, especially when I'm finishing a cue, I will actually, you know, label that cue after everything is bounced down and mixed for that cue for that scene. I will name the cue whatever I'm going to name it, but at the end of it, I will use underscores that has the actual time frame reference at the end. So, you know, if it's, you know, for the eighth scene that I'm scoring for a film, I'll call whatever that scene I'm going to call it. You know, if I call it like Girl at a Cafe in Paris, maybe that's just what I just called the music that I wrote for that particular scene. That's, you know, maybe 3 minutes long, but at the end of Girl in a Cafe in Paris, then I'll do underscore, you know, seven, underscore 28, underscore 15. So that way I'll know automatically that that wave file for that cue that I wrote will go at minute 7, 28 seconds, frame, whatever I said, 15, 10 or 15. I don't remember what I said, but 7, 28, 15, we'll just go with that. I give that file over to the director. They will automatically know that, okay, that's where I scored. That's where that cue is supposed to start. And it'll sync up perfectly when they import it into their video editing software that they use for syncing up everything with the soundtrack and the video and the film. So, you know, do a consistent naming convention, because I'm telling you, it's going to save you a lot of headaches and frustration. Because if you ever need to go back and look at something and make a revision, it may not even be doing something over. It could simply be just the director just saying, you know, maybe could you just add this? I like what you did. Could you maybe add one more element, or could you just take out one element but keep everything the same? Man, I mean, if you have already labeled everything, you already know where you are. You don't have to spend 30 minutes just listening, fast forwarding and rewinding, trying to figure out where did I put this. You're organized. You know exactly where everything is at. It's very important to label everything for the sense, you know, for organization. And do your files the same way, and do your folders the same way. There's an option in every operating system, whether you're on Mac or PC, where you can actually name your folder that your files are in. And if you're not doing that, get into the habit of creating folders for your projects. Don't just keep dumping. Don't, you know, the last thing you want to do is just start working on projects and you just have everything default to the root position of your hard drive where all of your audio is. And because if you do that, that's extremely disorganized. You could have like, you know, 10, 20, 30 different projects that you've worked on over a period of time. And when you open up that that audio drive, you're just going to see like hundreds of wave files. You're not going to have a clue of what's with what and what's where. They're just wave files to you. But if you have them in your own individual folder for that particular project, then you will know, you don't have to look elsewhere. Everything is going to be self-contained in that folder. Absolutely, absolutely be certain that you're putting everything in its own perspective folder for what you're working on in its own project and that particular scene. I do that all the time. I create a new folder for each new project, each new film that I'm working on. It's going to have its own folder. Within that folder, I'm going to create subfolders that are going to be just for the project itself, possibly, that I'm going to start and sequence everything in. And then I have a separate folder for just my, what I call stems, which are when you bounce down each individual MIDI track that you've composed and you bounce them down and you render them as audio files, which will be wave files. I default all of the wave files to that particular folder that I just call stems. And even when I get ready to mix, I'll have a separate folder, maybe sometimes just for the mixes themselves, the audio mix itself, when I get ready to mix all of the WAV files together into a finished two-track stereo that I can present to the director for that scene. You absolutely want to have everything organized. You absolutely want to have everything consistently, properly labeled. There's even a function, I know it is in Windows, and I know it is on the Mac as well, operating system. There's an option for you to actually change the icon, how your folder looks like. Because as a default, you know, your folders in your operating system pretty much look like, you know, a vanilla envelope or something. You can actually change that icon. There's a way for you to change the properties of that for it to look like something else. What I'll do a lot of times is I'll take that folder and I'll change it into something like a star, like a blue star or a gold star. And that folder, it's still a folder. It's just that it doesn't have the regular folder icon that you would normally see. And on my audio drive, of course, I have hundreds of files over the years of things that I've worked on. But if I open up my audio hard drive and look at the full list of everything that I have in there, you know, looking at a particular folder that looks like a star, like a blue star or a gold star or a red star, or it could look like, you know, some other symbol, some other icon that you want to use, it stands out automatically when you scroll. It stands out. So, you know, do those little things, do those little tricks to help you, because, you know, it will certainly help you with your first project that you're working on as a composer, but you'll be creating those exact same habits for recurring projects that you possibly may be working on in the near future as well. So, you know, if you start creating those habits, you know, you'll start to feel, you know, you'll start to find your groove. You'll start to find the same types of patterns that you know, will be comfortable for you. There's not a right or wrong way to do this. Whatever works for you, you know, whatever works for you as to how you want to label things, you know, how you want to organize things, as long as you understand it and there's some consistency to it. That's the only thing that matters. You don't have to follow and do it the way I do it or do it the way someone else does it. But, you know, if there are good suggestions that maybe you hadn't thought of before and you want to do it that way, then, you know, by all means, there's no reason to reinvent the wheel. There are plenty of people out there to have good suggestions as to how they've done it and it's worked for them. And if it works for you, it's nothing illegal for you to do it that way as well. You know, do whatever is available to you. But the worst thing you can do is not be organized as a composer. That's one of the worst things you can do as a film composer, especially for your first project. You absolutely want to be organized. The last thing you want to do is send the wrong file because you thought you were looking at this or that because it wasn't labeled properly and it looks the same as 40 other files you have in front of you. You do that, it makes you look incompetent. It makes you look like an amateur. It makes you also appear that maybe you just don't really care that much, you know? That maybe, you know, it really doesn't even matter to you whether or not you send the director or the editor or whomever the correct file. You know, that just kind of reeks of being nonchalant and not really having a seriousness in what you're doing. And, you know, that would be frustrating to the person that you're going to be creating the music for and sending it to. And, you know, it wouldn't look good on you. So just keep that in mind.